You're listening to Art House Radio, an Everything Arts podcast and an Art House 43 production. Visit arthouse43.com.
Welcome to Art House Radio, friends. I'm your host, Troy Ramos. If you're new to the show, welcome. If you're a returning listener, thanks for coming back. On this episode 162, we're talking about time. Do we need it? How are we spending it? And are there alternatives? We'll also talk my new impromptu notebook for sale on eBay, titled The Pointlessness of Time. It's January, what do you want? And we'll hear excerpts from really good articles found in the newest edition of the magazine New Philosopher, one of my favorites. It's Philosophy and the Art of Time, now on Art House Radio. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility, only in a world of speculation. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory, down the passage which we did not take, towards the door we never opened, into the rose garden. My words echo thus in your mind. T.S. Eliot. The happiest I can be is when I'm moving freely throughout my day, and frequenting sometimes between different locations to visit friends, family, and familiar settings. Back in spring 2015, I moved from Portland, Oregon to Michigan. Quite a change. Coming back to the state I'm originally from would have challenges, but at this moment, the move was fresh, and fresh is exactly what I was searching for. I had just had a successful art show after landing in Michigan and was settling into the beautiful landscapes, staying at a family home that was not only my childhood home, but also like the best of old friends, always there, always comfortable. My siblings and I would stay at this house whenever we were in town. It was a modest house owned by my parents, but neither had lived there for some time after they split up. It was like a family cabin, and I was here once again, starting out another adventure with a trusty companion by my side. Whenever I've made a big move in my life, my transition always included a stay at this house, for some time. It also included, of course, a decent amount of savings for the transition. So, once again, I was on familiar ground with a comfy nest egg, looking for the next experience, shaping the next platform for adventure that would inevitably arise. I mention this because it was a particularly special moment. I was in a familiar place, with money in my pocket, and all the time in the world. The inevitable dumb job would come, but for now, I was free. I was living the life I've always needed to have. I was the complete owner of my time. Nobody could tell me when to be somewhere. My days were completely free and could be organically shaped, like a Montessori approach to the everyday. I did what felt right. And even though the summer went by fast, I took in every moment of it like a precious resource. Why was that period of my life so much better than others? What was the real difference? Well, I'll tell you what it was. I hadn't given away my time to someone else. There was nobody from the Cool Ranch Doritos factory telling me to be at work by 9 or else. There was no cubicle that dictated how long I had for lunch. No well-intentioned but insignificant manager telling me how my week would go. It was mine. All the time was mine, and no matter if the days were lost or useful or productive, the most important thing was that they were mine to shape however I wanted. You see, there are two types of time, for the purposes of this episode at least. There's the time related to our consciousness, our place in this vast universe we know virtually nothing about, and there's the time that keeps you showing up on time to your job at the mall every day. One is an unbelievable experience with adventure and intrigue, and the other is potentially a weapon used by people, companies, and governments to control you and make sure that the stock market keeps rolling along. Now, I realize not everyone is unhappy with their job, and good for you if that's the case. I'm also aware that we need certain tasks to be accomplished in order to have the luxuries all the progress in recent centuries have afforded us. But this is not about avoiding tasks or responsibilities or carrying out important work. What I am talking about is how we accomplish completing tasks. Are we okay with the structure we have right now? Or are we starting to sense a movement to get our time back? To carry on completing potentially mundane tasks, even, as always, but in a different way? A recent survey in The Atlantic stated that 45% of the workday is used to complete work-related duties. That means 55% of your workday is spent sitting in a foreign place, almost against your will, doing things to pass the time rather than doing things you want or need to do. Why do we think nobody wants to be a farmer anymore? Do you know any 12-year-olds with black lung? The reasons we moved away from these things might have less to do with unions or policy than we think. How about the idea that people are slowly coming back around to the position that they want their time back? Nobody was working from home before a few decades ago. Nobody. And now it's a trend we see and one that might be growing in strength. If you only need to spend 45% of your day on work tasks, why not spend the other 55% of the rest of your day somewhere you choose to be? Laundry, cushy lunch, cush with lunch, dog walks, whatever. That would at least give you more control over your time, wouldn't it? Let's go back for a second to my magical summer in Michigan. There I was, in control of my time. I was working as a freelance artist, but I didn't have to be anywhere. My time was mine. Yes, some people with that kind of time might get up to no good. But why think the worst of humanity? The vast majority of people are good, so what would they accomplish or contribute if they were rulers of their day? They could develop hobbies that lead to meaningful or lucrative work. They could make discoveries. They could even become a better community member. You know what I did twice that magical summer? On two occasions, I got some garbage bags, gloves, and some solid podcasts and music on my phone, and I cleaned my neighborhood. I'm not kidding. I walked up and down both sides of the street for blocks, picking up trash that careless individuals discarded into lawns or on the side of the road. Why did I do that? Well, because I had the time. And I also had the time to realize that just maybe, if people saw me cleaning up, other people would help or clean up their neighborhood, or maybe seeing me pick up senseless trash would cause them to think twice about littering themselves next time. All because I had control of time. Maybe this is an argument about respect, about people having respect for other people's time and allowing them to spend this precious resource as they see fit. I bet we'd be surprised how much good people would do with it. Once the everyday person had taken it back, allowed themselves to breathe in life again, it's very possible that we could progress towards the world we actually hope for, one where every person, or many more people at least, get to operate with some flexibility in their lives. To be able to shape your day, yes, but also to have the freedom to respond to the universe as it happens. Some days would be unpredictable, yes, but at least it would be yours to deal with. After all, as they say, if you don't shape your own path, someone else will shape it for you. Don't let them. Before we launch into excerpts of articles from The New Philosopher, just want to mention a couple of things. I have a new sound and light installation premiering in Kalamazoo on March 1st, and I need some support for the materials, travel, and setup. You can read all the details at gofundme.com/arthopconnections if you can. I also have two new sound art albums, sort of ambient, sort of a music concrete, releasing in the next several weeks. The first one is called Rumble, and that's the one that has recorded sounds. It's like music concrete, and it's out on February 14th. That's the day of love. And Sound Space is the second one, and that's a sound art album. It's a sound art aspect of a sound and light installation which premiered at Art Prize 10 in Grand Rapids last fall. I really, really think you'll like these works if you're into ambient, thoughtful, minimalistic, and a bit experimental sound art music. So please pre-order the works now at my site, troyramos.bandcamp.com. I am also selling, I think, a notebook titled The Pointlessness of Time and Other Useless Observations on eBay. You can find that on there, or we'll link to it on the website, arthouse43.com. I decided, somebody gave me a work notebook, a tiny Mead notebook at work, and I decided to fill it up with my thoughts on time and how we waste it, hence the motivation for this episode. It's basically a book of troisms I wrote while at work over the course of a few days. So please, if you get a chance, make your bids now. There is only one copy and you could own it. And finally, remember to follow us everywhere at arthouse43. I'm also on Instagram at TroystonD. And write to us at arthouse43.com if you have a second. Support the arts. I am Become Sound. Support those projects. Things are going well on Bandcamp, so if you can get out there and have a listen and see what you think about possessing the new two albums, Rumble and Sound Space, that would be great. All right, let's get to the main act here. These are excerpts from the New Philosopher magazine, Use Your Time Wisely. Enjoy. The following is an excerpt from the magazine New Philosopher, Use Your Time Wisely. This article is titled The Thieves of Time by Oliver Berkman. It's already a cliche to observe that we live in an attention economy, in which the most valuable commodities are the eyeballs and brains of web users, paid for by advertisers, keen to reach ever more precisely targeted audiences. That's the meaning of the insight that, when it comes to seemingly free services such as social media, if you're not paying for it, you're the product. Yet, generally, we treat the downsides of this situation as limited in scope. For example, we worry about what happens to responsible journalism in an era when social media rewards sensationalism. Or we treat online distractions as a relatively minor obstacle to getting things done. We fail to see that what's really at stake is our finite time on Earth. As the progenitor of modern psychology, William James, put it, "My experience is what I agree to attend to." In other words, attention is life. A life is nothing more or less than the sum of what fills the attentional bandwidth of the person living it. The psychotherapist David Reynolds points out that if you're not paying attention to a personal problem, a recent breakup, say, there's a meaningful sense in which you don't have a problem at all. So it follows that when some corporate player in the attention economy succeeds in capturing your attention, they're determining in some small way how you live your life. When you pay attention, the technology scholar James Wilson Williams has argued, you pay with all the things you could have attended to, but didn't. All the goals you didn't pursue. All the possible yous you could have been, had you attended to those other things. Attention is paid in possible futures foregone. If we rarely think of the battle for attention in such terms, that's partly because it's still not widely appreciated how devastatingly effective the tech firms have become at seizing it. The media industry has always been an attention economy of sorts, but the online version is no mere continuation of a trend. As you scroll through the feeds on your phone, your every act is recorded, including the motion of your device, which, according to some reports, can be used to determine your gait and, thus, your mood. Behind the scenes, algorithms ceaselessly tailor your browsing experience, learning what compels your attention, so as to direct more of it your way. Meanwhile, tiny tweaks to each app's interface, such as exactly how and when you're notified about new likes, are tested on different groups of users, the most effective ones then spreading through the network, in kind of a Darwinian evolution of attention mining techniques. As the former tech employee turned attention activist Tristan Harris likes to say, every time you visit a major app or site, there are 1,000 people on the other side of the screen paid to undermine your self-control. If the organizations that harnessed our attention in this fashion used it to make us happier or better informed, their tactics might be partially defensible, but that's not what happens. The attention economy is agnostic on the question of whether what you're seeing is consoling or outraging, true or false. All that matters is that it compels, and, as we're learning, outrage. Inducing falsehoods often do best on that score. Making matters worse, attention comes with a built-in trap. By definition, once yours has been seized, you can't also be aware, at least in the same moment, that it has been seized. And so, the better others become at taking control of our attention, the harder it gets to stay focused on the fact that they're doing so. The following is an excerpt from the magazine New Philosopher. The article is titled Life in the Fast Lane by Andre Dow. Deep in the Amazonian rainforest, in the Brazilian state of Rondônia, lives the Amandawa tribe, a people without a sense of time. Does that mean that they live in a perpetual present? That for this tribe nothing has ever happened and nothing ever will? Well, not quite. What the Amandawa lack is a linguistic term for the abstract concept of time. More specifically, researchers who spent time with the Amandawa claimed that the tribe lacked what some experts had thought to be a universal trait, the metaphoric mapping of time using the lexicon and grammar of space and motion. In other words, unlike just about every language ever studied, the Amandawa language doesn't use terms like forwards and backwards to describe the movement of time. In fact, for the Amandawa, time doesn't move at all. The researchers' findings, published in a paper called When Time Is Not Space, were reported around the world as a bit of odd spot news. How strange, these reports implied, a people without time, or at least without the technology of time. No calendars, no clocks. It's little wonder that the story was so popular. For what is more characteristic of the modern condition than the hold time has over our mental lives? Whole industries have formed around squeezing more into less time, complete with their own corresponding buzzword, productivity. So the idea of a timeless people without meetings to get to, deadlines to fulfill, and schedules to maintain was an exotic diversion over a morning cup of coffee before heading into peak hour to get to the office. But just how stable is our own sense of time? What exactly is this concept of abstract time that we apparently have and that the Amandawa lack? A simple answer would point to purportedly objective time, the seconds, minutes, and hours into which all time is divided. Yet that answer, as obvious as it seems, is only part of the story. For time itself has a history. We can trace the modern history of time, as the geographer David Harvey does, to medieval Europe, of course. Time, as we know it, was inaugurated during the transition from agrarian life, with its natural rhythms guided by the seasons and the sun, to town life. In particular, it was the needs of the growing class of merchants that drove this change, for they needed more accurate and predictable measures of time for the orderly conduct of business. So it was that life in medieval towns that became punctuated by the sound of bells, calling workers to labor and merchants to market. In his seminal work, The Condition of Postmodernity, Harvey argues that capitalism, which was appearing in medieval towns in prototypical form, required the speeding up of social processes to maintain itself. In short, a capitalist has to find ways for their capital to make a return faster than their competitors. They do so in one of three ways: speeding up work processes, speeding up physical production, or speeding up consumption. A really clever capitalist, of course, will do all three. Harvey calls this process time-space compression, whereby the pace of life gets faster while spatial barriers collapse so as to make the world seem smaller. Think, for example, of the way Marshall McLuhan's Global Village. ahead of its time, when he coined it in the 1960s, is now an everyday reality. According to Harvey, time-space compression so revolutionizes the objective qualities of time and space that we are forced to alter, sometimes in quite radical ways, how we represent the world to ourselves. In other words, we should think of time not simply as an objective measurement, like a meter or a gram, but as a mental structure. And what's more, a mental structure that changes according to changes in social organization. Thus, the way a poor man in Elizabethan England experienced time was not fixed over the course of his life. In early adulthood, living off his small plot of land, he worked to the rhythm of subsistence farming. But when the rural poor were expropriated from the land, creating a new class of laborers, our farmer had to adjust to new working hours. That didn't come naturally. In fact, it only occurred on a cross-society level because the new laboring class were disciplined by harsh poor laws, forcing them to accept wage labor. That is, work paid on the basis of time. Time-space compression is thus about a particular relationship between technology and our minds. Innovations like telephones, the wireless, bicycles, automobiles, airplanes, and the internet have provided the material foundation for new ways of thinking about time and space. A quick look at how the 20th century unfolded, from Simmel's punctual city dweller to today's gig economy worker, provides ample evidence of this relationship at work. In the early 1900s, Henry Ford used spatial organization, the assembly line, to accelerate the speed of production. Then, in the 1970s, when the gains from Fordism were all but exhausted, companies turned to subcontracting, outsourcing, and just-in-time delivery systems to achieve time gains. But by far the most noticeable speeding up has been the increase in consumption. It began with inbuilt obsolescence. Companies started working out that making a consumer good that lasted a lifetime wasn't a great business model. But even replacing broken-down goods every few years wasn't enough to keep the economy in overdrive. Instead, it was the extension of fashion, once only an elite concern, but to the mass market, that really put consumption into the fast lane. Now, whether it's clothes or phones or travel, last year's product is outmoded.